Good evening, everybody. The meeting is recording. It's 6:30 p.m. on January 30th, 2024. Ms. Hiller, after you call the meeting to order, we'll do a roll call of the committee members and continue on with the meeting.
Well, then I officially call this meeting to order. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you. Since this is the first time, we're probably just going to run through the names. So after I call your name, just take a minute to introduce yourself and so the other committee members can get to know you. And it doesn't look at this point like we have anybody else joining us, but they may pop in. Ms. Hiller.
Yes, my name is Peg Hiller. I've been a physical therapist for about 200 years. I'm happy to share this. That's because I think we have a focus and a purpose. And you all may know I worked for the licensing board for 10 years as their investigator and compliance specialist. I have 25 years in clinical practice. I taught for 10 years after I left the board job in jurisprudence and documentation and use of personnel. I was president of the Arizona chapter when we replaced the very archaic statutes in Arizona with the first edition of the Model Practice Act. We're now on, I think, version 7. So I've got a pretty deep understanding of the law and the rules and where we're going with this.
Dr. Bustillo.
Karen Bustillo, just retired from a 44-year clinical practice. I've been on the State Board of Physical Therapy for 4 years and was just elected as president for this coming year. I've been involved with the APTA and AZPTA for many, many years. This is the first time I've been involved in this type of a committee. So I'm very much looking forward to hearing everybody's insights and see what I can do to contribute.
Mr. Leone.
Yeah, I'm Giovanni Leone. I've been a PTA since 2012. As I mentioned, I work for Empower, which is an outpatient private practice here in Arizona and several other states. I've been within the compliance realm for a little over 5 years now. I've been on the board for a couple of years. And then I'm also part of the ABC APTA practice committee as well. This is also my first time on a committee like this. So I'm looking forward to learning from everybody and being a part of it.
Mr. Bursell is not yet here. We'll circle back to him if he joins.
I am present.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. Well, I've been practicing for just over 3 years now. I'm working at an outpatient orthopedic clinic. Just moved up to a clinic director position there. I was involved in the student state board in Colorado. So I've been trying to get my foot in the door and do some work for the state board here in Arizona now.
Fantastic. Dr. Bursell, we don't see you in this meeting. Are you in the executive session meeting? Are you in both meetings?
Maybe. I joined the one that was sent to me for the Google Meet on the email.
There were two that would have been sent to you.
Okay.
Two separate meetings, and I'm kind of thinking you might be in the executive session meeting and not in our meeting.
Okay. So should I log out and then try to find that other one?
Yes. Hold on just 1 second. Peg, I think you're logged into both meetings because we're actually hearing him through your connection.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, bear with me just a second. I'm going to hang up this meeting, and I will be right back.
And do I need to log out of the other? Judy, log
out. Just hang tight for a minute. I'm going to pop into the other one and see what I see.
I see AJ in the other one.
Okay, yes, Peg, you are in this one.
Well, go ahead and just hang up this one, but leave your tab open.
Got it. Leave the tab open, but hang up.
Is that perfect? I hope I have the last two because I know it's the problem.
Now there's something wrong with your microphone, Peg. Your sound is wobbly.
So,
we can hear you, but we can't understand you.
Now, the stuff is coming in at I still got it.
Yeah. So, Peg, what you might want to do is after Judy comes back in, you might need to hang up and then rejoin this.
Okay.
So, Judy, we're having some trouble with Peg's audio now that she's asking the other one. So, I think she might need to just log out and log back into this meeting.
Yes, let's try it.
There you go. We can hear you. Try logging out of this one and just rejoining it. Okay. I didn't think to stop the recording before I exited, so we've been recording. Hopefully you've had an enjoyable conversation. Okay, we'll give Peg a minute to rejoin. There she is. Now you're muted, Peg.
How about now? Is the audio improved?
Much better. There we go.
Thank you. Where were we?
There we go. Okay.
We were on your introductions.
We were on the introductions, and I was just calling Dr. Bursell.
Okay. So to revisit, I've been practicing for about 3 years. I've been working at an outpatient orthopedic clinic, and I used to serve on the student state board in Colorado while I was in PT school. So since I've moved back out here to Arizona, I've been trying to get more involved on the state board side of things.
Good. Welcome.
And Dr. Bordenave.
Hey everybody, I'm Lori Bordenave. I am the chair of the physical therapy department at ATSU. I've been a physical therapist, not for as long as Peggy, but for quite a long time, for over 30 years. I've served on a lot of ATA committees and both appointed and elected, but I've never served on something like this. And so I'm excited to learn more about the process and how we go about it. And I hope I can bring that back to my students.
Fantastic. And Ms. Hunter, we found out today that Ms. Hunter, just for the record, had to resign the committee. So we'll continue on. Dr. Linsky.
Hey everyone, Jim Linsky. I've been a physical therapist now about 28 years, most of it in Arizona, but some of it in DC. I currently am chair of the Department of Physical Therapy for Creighton University here in Phoenix. I've been involved nationally with the APTA in multiple positions and with the AZ-APTA as a delegate. Under Blair's mentorship for a little bit, for about the last 4 years or so, and now I'm currently vice president of our chapter.
Oh, awesome.
And never been on anything like this before, so looking forward to it.
And Mr. Packard?
Thank you. Excuse me, Blair Packard. I came to Arizona in 1976, was licensed, and I think the only one on here longer than that was Peggy. Fun facts, Peggy and I were colleagues at County Hospital, my first position, and that may have been Peggy's first, I don't remember, but we worked together there for a while. And then we also, Peggy and I, started the chapter newsletter, the APTAN, all those many years ago, and I used to collate that around my kitchen table, and Peggy and I would edit that, and that's, we got to start as co-workers that far back. I have been involved with FEED in both regulatory and professional, you know, fields. I'm a private practitioner now. I work at, I own East Valley Physical Therapy, still practicing 3 days a week, trying to work my way into retirement one of these days. I've been involved. I've been chapter president in the past. I was involved with the licensing board. I was on the licensing board for 5 years. I became involved with the APTA. I was on the APTA board of directors, chapter president, private practice board. When I worked with the Federation, I was first asked to chair the Model Practice Act task force. So we worked for 4 years to develop that, the Model Practice Act. And I was involved with the first three editions. Peggy was involved with one of those editions, I think the third or fourth. And we worked together on that, on editing that. When we brought that to that first edition to Arizona, I was the legislative committee chair under Peggy's presidency, and we got that adopted in 1 year. I became the president of the Federation. I served 2 terms as the president of the Federation. My most recent involvement with the APTA, I chaired a special committee that reviewed all of the policy documents of the APTA board of directors, and we revised all those documents and brought those up today. So I've had a lot of background in looking at documents, you know, every practice act in this country, the Model Practice Act, the policy documents. And so I hope I can bring that kind of background to this committee just from a study of the words of our profession.
Well said.
And Dr. Kuhn. Oh, you're muted, Dr. Toon. I'm sorry, our Brady Bunch scene moved around, so I lost you for a minute there.
Yeah, and I try to keep it muted so I'm not saying something I shouldn't. So some of you know that may be true. So I've been a PT for about 24 years, and I've been involved with the AZPTA and have been mentored by Peggy for decades. Thank you, even today. And I've been on various committees, AZPTA, and mentoring through the APTA, national boards for research through the APTA and through the National Spina Bifida Association, as well as local board member volunteering there. And I have various revenue streams. I work still at Children's Rehab Services, but I generally do not see a lot of children because I serve the underserved, and those are the people, the teenagers and the young adults that need services, and do a lot of equipment and resource sharing through my clinic. I work with the physicians directly in some of my clinics, which is really awesome. So I really get to use that DPT, get to play doctor. And other various revenue streams related to documentation.
Fantastic. Well, I think that is all the members. My name is Judy Chepius. I am the executive director of the board. In a previous life, I worked with the association, worked there for 4 years in the administration. And after that, I worked at the Federation for about 6 years. Specializing mainly in the continuing competence department. And then I landed in the board as a part-time assistant. It was a nice little part-time job helping people, helping staff, helping people on the phone. I enjoyed that. And then I landed in this chair. So for better or worse, here we are.
Well, let me welcome you all and say I'm really pleased to have such a diverse and talented group of people to apply ourselves to the job ahead. Just kind of in some general terms, this meeting is to kind of get our sense of purpose, to understand the scope of what we're doing, get some background, and Judy will launch on agenda. I'm skipping agenda item 3 if you've got your agendas there, because we have no minutes to adapt. So I've gone to agenda item 4. So today we get to know each other a little bit. We look at the big picture of what are we doing with this 5-year rules review. We kind of start talking about where we think maybe we need to look closer, do some research, do some study, see if there are areas of our current rules that we may want to explore and reach out into our communities, because I think it's important that everybody from the PT Association to the academic community to the employers of physical therapists, we all see physical therapy in different spotlights, so to speak. So we network, we come back together, we get the job done. So that being said, let me see if Judy would kind of go over in general terms what a 5-year rules review is all about.
Well, in preparing for this task, I came across a presentation that's on the Governor's Rules Review Council website. So I think the easiest way and most complete way to do this is to share that with you. So I'm going to share my screen. Google Meets presents a little bit of a problem with trying to get the audio. So we're going with a very low tech. I'm going to play it on my phone for you and watch it on the video. So bear with me just a minute while I share my screen. Okay. Sorry. I said this was low tech. I wasn't kidding. I got to get them both lined up here.
What is a...
Okay. All right. Everybody can see my screen, right?
What is a 5-year review report? Most agencies are required to review all of their rules once every 5 years, including rules made pursuant to an exempt rulemaking. This is called a 5-year review report. Review of rules is scheduled by article and is typically due on the last business day of the month. Agencies are notified of the upcoming deadline to submit their report at least 90 days before a report is due. When the report is due, it must be submitted electronically to FERC@azdoa.gov. 5-year review reports allow agencies to regularly revisit their rules to identify potential issues, determine whether any rule should be amended or repealed, develop a proposed course of action to address issues identified in the report, and guide the agency's future rulemaking activity, assemble and preserve institutional knowledge, and prevent rules under review from expiring. Every 5-year review report must contain a concise analysis of the following for each rule under review. Are the rules effective in achieving their objectives? Have any written criticisms of the rules been received during the past 5 years? What is the statutory authority for the rules? Are the rules consistent with statutes and other rules? Are the rules being enforced as written? Are the rules clear, concise, and understandable? What is the current economic impact of the rules as compared to the last economic, consumer, and small business impact statement if one was prepared? Was a business competitiveness analysis submitted? Was the proposed course of action in the previous 5-year review report completed? Do the rules impose the least burden and cost to persons regulated by the rules? Are the rules more stringent than federal law? Do the rules require the issuance of a general permit, or does the agency meet the exceptions of using a general permit? When an agency is getting ready to prepare their five-year review report for submission, council staff recommends agencies to take the following steps. In addition to reviewing this video, become familiar with the five-year review report flowchart on GRC's website, which outlines the process in more detail. Review the agency's last five-year review report for the given article. If you have difficulty locating an older report, EIS, or rulemaking, contact council staff for assistance. Review the last economic, small business, and consumer impact statement for the rules to get a better sense of what the estimated economic impact of the rules were at the time they were created or amended. We also encourage each agency to contact council staff with any questions they may have during the preparation of their report. Once complete, the agency submits their cover letter and a five-year review report to the council electronically at GRC@azdoa.gov. If an agency is unable to submit a report by the deadline, the agency has the option to request an extension to submit the report. The agency may request a one-time 120-day extension that is automatically granted, or an extension longer than 120 days, but no longer than a year, which must be approved by the council. Additionally, the agency may request that the council reschedule the report or a portion of the report if the rules being reviewed were initially made or substantially revised within 2 years before the due date of the report. This moves the deadline to submit the report out another 5 years. Templates for submissions are available on GRC's website. The council may take one of two actions on five-year review reports submitted by an agency. It can vote to either approve the report or return the report. If the council approves a report, no further action is required. However, the council may vote to return a report either in full or in part if the report fails to include the appropriate analysis for the rules as outlined previously. Thereafter, the council, in consultation with the agency, will schedule submission of a revised report by the agency. Council staff will always work with the agency to identify and address any issues with the report in an attempt to avoid a report being returned. While a report on a given article is typically due once every 5 years, the council may require the agency to review the rules prior to the next regularly scheduled report if the council determines that potential issues with the rules require prompt attention. For more information on 5B review reports, please visit our website at GRC.az.gov.
Thank you, Judy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a lot of material to cover, and all of that will not be under the responsibility of this committee. Once we have met, once we've had some time, some months, some discussions, and come up with some recommendations, it goes back to the board, and at that point, the board and staff will monitor the process from that point on. So our role is actually for the fact-finding, for the discussions, for reaching out to our communities to see what's coming down the pike that might require some adjustments. But that was a big overview, and not all of those things will be the responsibility of this group. Correct, Judy?
Correct.
Okay, so I'm going to go to agenda item 4B, which is to talk about the snag that I alluded to when we first formed the committee last fall. And as it turns out, the last five-year rules review occurred in 2019. It was then with Karen Donahue as executive director. And the rules package was assembled at that point. By and large, it was administrative improvements. It was updating to match technology today. I mean, no longer do we need to have everything done on paper. Things can be submitted electronically. There were a number of changes that we'll talk about in a minute that were studied and developed. And a final recommendation, which is called a notice of proposed rulemaking, was drafted late in 2019. At that point, I'm afraid Karen Donahue exited the picture thanks to her untimely death, a loss to all of us. I mean, she was a very dear friend of many of us. And the process kind of went into limbo. We had new staff. We had Judy come on and come take over as the executive director. The board had to shift, and it kind of fell by the wayside is the closest I can come up with. Now, the board does utilize the service of a consultant who is a specialist in rules writing. You will hear Jeannie's name many times. Excuse me, her name is Jeannie Hahn. And when we reached out knowing that 2024 was going to be a deadline for another five-year rules review, and Judy and I reached out to Jeannie Hahn about how to proceed, she was the one that allowed us to know that the 2019 rules review was never completed. And we really can't launch into the process of the 2024 rules review until we wrap up 2019. From the perspective of this committee, the work has been done. It was done in 2019. Judy and I have met with Jeannie Hahn. There were a few extra things we added as technology has changed. And I'm going to pause for a minute to make sure all of you got the link to the shared folder. All right, Jim, who didn't? Raise your hand if you didn't get it. Jim, you did not.
No, I'm searching my email and I can't find anything.
Okay, well, that'll be down for Judy to resend the link. But for those of you that found it, it included the agenda for this meeting. It included updated, and I put a watermark on it, copy of the administrative rules as they will be once the 2019 changes have been completed. I did not want the committee to spend time talking about things that have already substantially been changed.
So that draft we're looking at is the 2019 packet.
Correct. And what it includes, because the notice of proposed rulemaking just excerpts the sections of the rules that are going to be changed. So I took those changes and I put it into a document that included our current rules. I know this is too small for you to see. And I put in bold, either bold underline for language that is added or bold strike through for language that has been deleted. So as you look at these rules, they're not exactly the rules that exist because we are in limbo between the rules prior to 2019 and the changes that the board sought. I'll give you a simple example. In the old rules, the rules identified each and every question that was asked on an application for a license or certificate. That is no longer the case. We now, in the 2019 rules, refer to an application available on the board's website. So all those questions in the rules in that section have strike through because in 2019, that material was supposed to be deleted. So I hope it's not too confusing. Okay, go ahead there.
Let me just ask one more quick question. Does submitting that now to GIRC prejudice at all the work that we will do in following up with a package, you know, for 2024? Is that going to influence what GIRC does or what our board does with the work that this committee will do?
I don't know, Blair. It depends on what the output of this committee is. I mean, if we're going to rewrite every rule, I don't know. Certainly the changes from 2019 were far more administrative to facilitate the efficacy and efficiency of the board. They were not substantive changes. So it kind of depends. I don't know how to answer that question. Jeannie would answer it better. And I would anticipate that at our next meeting, I will perhaps invite Jeannie to sit in on a meeting and she might be able to answer questions like that. Judy, is that the kind of thing we could do to invite someone to the meeting?
Invite her to the meeting? Absolutely. This is a public meeting, so anybody can come.
So we will get to that, Blair. I just don't know.
All right. Thanks.
And go ahead, Lori.
Yeah, so my question is,
there's a lot of links in the folder. Can you tell me what I should be looking at, like what the title of the document is that I should be looking at? Because the titles don't necessarily help me know what you're talking about.
I can.
And that's my ignorance. I apologize.
What I'm talking about is RC draft rules, Title 4, Chapter 24, and it's got today's date on it. RC stands for Rules Committee. And make sure I get to the right one, not that one.
Yep, I can see now it says bold and underlined additions.
Correct.
And strike through duty.
The watermark is so that you will know this is a copy that is for the Rules Committee use, right? Because the only way for us to go forward is to be aware of what should have changed in 2019 that fell off the apple cart.
Gotcha.
Basic statute and rules information, the statute, which is the law, is really the legal standard of practice of physical therapy in Arizona. The administrative code, which are the rules, are intended to clarify, elaborate on the law. It cannot be different than the law. We are constrained in the rules to address the world of physical therapy as statute allows. So if we as a rules committee said, well, you know, we'd really like to get the PT tech out of care, but we're going to draft rules that say only PTAs and PTs can treat patients. Well, we can't do that because statute very clearly establishes a tier of personnel that our PT, I call them PT techs because PTA and PT aid when I talk fast is confusing. So included in that folder is a copy of the statutes. Those are going to be labeled statutes, Title 32, Chapter 19. And their effective date was in July of 2023, I think. Okay? And then Judy loaded up a number of links that may be helpful to us as we deliberate and go through the next several months of discussions. Might be helpful to be able to look at. I did include a copy of something that's identified on the drive as substantive policy statements. Those are official statements that are adopted by the Board of Physical Therapy as their way of interpreting or clarifying to the public and the profession how they understand the rules and the statute as it affects real life practice, substantive policy statements. They're not adopted too often. They are specific to certain topics that are going to be reviewed. I will use as an example, I know I'm elaborating from 2019, but oh well. Let's see if I can remember my example of substantive policy statement. I am sure we will get into some discussions about categories of assistive personnel. I anticipate there is some interest in looking at that category of assistive personnel as it pertains to students. Okay, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but let's say, for instance, that was going to be something we discuss. And the reality is that the determination that students were part of the ratio of assistive personnel is not written in the rules. It evolved from a substantive policy statement that the board adopted that indicated that they interpreted the definitions of assistive personnel in statute and rules as including students on their clinical internships. Okay, we're not going to get into that discussion tonight. Don't worry. But it's an example that demonstrates why I used as a resource the substantive policy statements, because they are board opinions. They're adopted by the board, okay, but they are just that. They are interpretations and opinions. And so as we get into things that are in the rules, we may well have reason to look at substantive policy statements and see how those influence how we proceed. I kind of tried to put a two-hour lecture into maybe 10 minutes. Go ahead, Blair.
That's great. Good information. So let me just ask one more hypothetical. What if we go through and we find something in rules that we obviously can't change because statute says it differently, but we might want to leave a list of items and explanations, you know, for the board to take a look at. I'll give you an example. Here's a primary example. We use delegation frequently, you know, throughout both statutes and rules, the word delegation. And now delegation does not appear anywhere in all of our profession's documents, nor in the Model Practice Act, nor in all house policies do we use the word delegation because of the implication that you're handing over authority. We use direction and supervision as the phrase now in all professional documents. So we can't change that in rules because it's in our statutes. But would that be an example of something we could just leave a note? This is a note for the licensing board. At some point in the future, when you get around to changing this, this would make this more consistent across the board.
I would say it's critical that we do just that. Identify those areas that are no longer contemporary or appropriate for contemporaneous practice. And when the time comes to look at statutory changes, that's when the board might want to pursue that kind of a change. So it's critical that we identify those areas that would require some statutory revision.
Okay, thanks.
Of course. Oh, JJ, you have a face. Hi, JJ. any other questions about kind of the big picture and what happened with the 2019 five-year rules review and why right now it's proceeding in the process of trying to get before GRC, that's the governor's regulatory review council, and that is the agency that oversees administrative rules and rulemaking. And as a companion, while we are digesting and processing what further needs to be addressed in rules, Judy and Jeannie and their cohorts are going to be walking through the 2019 rules with, ideally, Jeannie would say it's 10 months from the filing of the notice of proposed rulemaking until it makes its way through GRC. I mean, this is now January, so I'm certainly hopeful that we will be able to jumpstart that by the end of this month or very beginning of February. And at that point, if we need to ask for a, what's it called, Judy? If we need to ask for an extension, because we are required in 2024 to once again do a five-year rules review. If we need to ask for an extension because we're not ready to do it because we're still hung up in 2019, we will use whatever is available in the process so that we can get the job done for 2024. And our role will not be to muck around with 2019. You can see what was done or hope to be done in 2019, and it's going to be all the bold text in the RC draft rules 013024 document. We're good?
Just one thing to add, Peg. It's our understanding also that with the 2019, that will probably be in process when we still, the 2019 changes will probably still be in process when we finalize the report for the 2024. One of the items of that will be to explain where we stand with all of the 2019 items, and we'll be able to say, you know, we are at XYZ point in that process.
We good?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here's the big picture. I'm on agenda item 4C, which is expectations and goals. And so we've kind of gotten the background done. And this group, over the course of the next, and I am anticipating 8 months, okay? It depends on how fast we work and how much work there is to do, are going to start talking about things that maybe could be updated or revised in the rules because the profession has moved in that direction. I mean, there was a time when dry needling didn't exist in statutes because it didn't exist in practice, and now it's ever present. So we're going to kind of slug through the rules and see what might need some exploration. And then we will, as a group, I think, break into subgroups so we're not all doing the same things and say, okay, these people on our rules committee are going to specifically be looking at practice of physical therapy, whatever it is we've identified. And this group, whether they're the academicians or the lay people or the board members, these are the people that are really going to look at use of personnel and see where we need to go with that. And there may be some interest in taking a good hard look at the continuing competence language. I sure hope so, because it's a quagmire out there. I mean, if Judy and I could rewrite the rules, we would just say you got to have some continuing competence and here's how many hours you need. You know, it's either category A or something else. Anyway, not to diverge too much, but if we tonight can get a grasp going through Article 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and some of them, Article 5 is public participation. I don't think we're going to do anything with that one. Look at the big picture and see if we can get to the point of who wants to look into what. What communities do we need to outreach? I know we do have committee members who are very active in the physical therapy, Arizona Physical Therapy Association, right? And I know they have their own legislative agenda. They have some issues they are anxious to deal with. I think it's important from the get-go that we tie into that, because it would be painful if we spent 8 months working on rules only to drop them, right, have them submitted, and to open it up for public comment and have all kinds of people come out of the woodwork and say, yeah, but you didn't do this, and yeah, we wanted that. So I would like us to encompass various communities of interest who might have thoughts about how they'd like these rules to go. Remember, we are constrained by statute. So nothing we can do in these rules can go against what current statute says. Copacetic expectations and rules are good. So I, you know how old I am. I'm 150, almost. I feel like 150, but I work better on paper, so I print things. If you can look at your screens, but unless there's further discussion or questions, everybody's okay with where we're at right now. And this is a free-for-all, so whether you keep your mic off or on, raise your hand, do whatever you have to do. I don't really use chats because I figure, well, there are 8 of us plus Judy, and so we're all in the same room. Let's talk to each other. And now I will silence myself so we can work it through. But I think we have to start with Article 1. Does everybody have a copy or looking at a screen? Would it be more helpful if Judy goes and puts her screen up? Anybody? You want to see it on a screen, or do you all have copies you're looking at?
I can look at my copy.
I can look at mine.
Yeah, I can look at mine.
I have mine up too.
Dr. Linsky, do you now have a copy you can look at? Okay, we're good.
Can you please just call me? What's this Dr. Linsky stuff? Please.
I'll call you Dr. Jim. How about Jim?
Yes, I finally got access. I had to use my ATSU back door there, Lori, to get in, because for some reason, Creighton and Google don't match. So.
Interesting.
Well, we still like
here. Yeah.
Okay, so Article 1, general provisions. That includes definitions that are used in the rules, right? That includes the board officers. It includes a definition of confidential information. It includes fees. And you can see from the bold font that some things were eliminated. Duplicate license. I mean, you don't need to request that. You can download it. And so more the administrative processes of the board. Anybody offhand? I mean, the biggest change I think was we dumped the PT/PTA versions of the CPI clinical performance instrument and just adopted a definition of what a clinical performance instrument is, whether it's for a PT or a PTA. I'm trying to see any significant. 2019 did expand the recognized standards of ethics, which never did include the PT assistant standards. The only thing that at the time was in the MPA that we adopted here in Arizona was a code of ethics and the guide for professional conduct for the PT. So in 2019, or maybe it was more recent than that, we have inserted the documents that are appropriate for PT assistant standards of practice, if you will.
But Peg, let me ask you this question. So that's paragraph 32. Would those be updated to more current additions before you submit the 2019 package, or would that be to our group to work for this next submission to bring those up to date?
I would say yes, because I don't want to. Is there a more current edition than what we have cited?
Yes.
For which one?
I think the code of ethics for sure has been updated since 2019. Jim?
August of 2020 is the date it's on here in bold print.
Right.
Yeah, I think.
I'd have to go back and look. I'd have to check it first. Maybe I'm speaking too quickly. I'll have to go back and look.
I mean, the last up.
I know we had the discussion, Jim, regarding around sexual harassment. Was that in the 2020 version or is that later? You're muted.
I don't know off the top of my head. I don't. I have to
do research. I'll be happy to go back and check.
I had a question about the fees. Is that pretty difficult to have those kinds of things listed in a rule? Because it would seem then that would mean that you'd be restricted in increasing the fees until you have every time. So is that pretty typical?
Judy, you want to?
Yes, it's typical to have them in the rules. The rule changes are not restricted to every 5 years. They're required every 5 years to have this report with GRC. That's the Governor's Rules Review Council. It's just commonly called GRC, G-R-R-C. So if there were a fee change that could be requested, that hasn't happened for a long, long time. And there is a statute that outlines maximums that can be utilized. So having them in the rule supports, the fact that this board has always remained under what the statute allows to charge for fees, for application fees.
That is true. I'm looking to see the citation for statute, and it's a ceiling of fees in statute. It can't be more than $500, or I'm looking for it in term permits. I think fees are at the end of Article 2. Forgive me. I thought I had these memorized.
Peg, it's 32-2029.
Thank you very much. 32-2029 establishes ceilings, which are in statute, $300 for an application, $300 for certificate renewal, certificate renewal. We don't charge $300 for renewal. It's far shorter than that, but these are ceilings in statute. So rules are constrained to be less than that ceiling.
But gotcha.
Blair, you know other statutes better than I. I kind of think most rules do have to identify in writing what the fees are.
I don't recall for sure. I was just looking at the ethics documents, and the 2020 date is correct.
Yes.
So
I kind of thought, so it's the ones that are posted on the board's website. So we pulled those dates, so they should be current.
So There is a concern that's been brought up about a fee structure. I don't know if this is the time to discuss it or later, but it's for new graduates who get licensed in a renewal year in April, May, June, or even July, and they have to pay their 160, or sorry, they pay their 190, and then in August, they've got to pay 160.
What I'm hearing is something that has been discussed before, which has to do with a grace period. So, and that's definitely something I think we should look at within the context of if your license is, you know, 2 years or less, you don't have a continuing competence. Are we talking about the same things or not?
The continuing competence isn't in this part. I was looking at R424-107 fees that we're talking about right now. There has been a discussion brought up about by the early career SIG, by student SIG, by educators, about the, you know, if you're a new graduate and you get licensed for your first time, let's say July, you pay a license year.
Uh-huh.
The fee is $190 to get that license. Then a month later, you have to turn around and pay another $160 to renew your license.
Karen, Giovanni, has the board talked about this at all, looked at fees? Definitely, that's something that we're going to put on the list, and some of us are going to look into how that could be addressed. Judy, we could look into that, right?
We can look into that, but I might suggest that this is a conversation to be a part of 401 with respect to R424-401 explains the renewal requirements and when the renewal needs to occur. So perhaps it's a hybrid of, Peg, what you were kind of leaning towards with the grace period issue. Just, you know, licensed in such and such a time frame. Currently the rule says that if you're licensed in the second year of a competent cycle, your fee is prorated, but it doesn't make any kind of accommodations for those renewal fees. So I think it's less, if correct me if I'm wrong, Jim, but I think what you're discussing is less necessarily of a fee structure change versus a reprieve from just submitting and then turning around to renew. And that could be a time frame thing. I understand that it hits students because they're students, but it's all, you know, it's the same rule, whether they're a student or coming in by endorsement or anything else. It's the same renewal rule.
Judy or Peggy, the GERC training video mentioned a rules impact study or statement. Have we ever done one of those?
I'm not real sure. Honestly, this is my first time through this, so I'm not real certain how that has looked. And I think when you do an impact study, What GERC is going to look at for certain is the fact that any rules that the committee puts forth and what the impact will be on the public, on the, you know, I mean, the board's role is to protect the public. The board's role is not to protect the practitioner, so to speak. So there's that kind of thing. Of course, changing fees to make it a little bit easier to lower barriers to entry, all of that kind of stuff, it would be discussed and could be potentially seen in a good light. But the agency has to continue on too. And this is an agency that builds a fund for itself for it to continue to do its work.
that video just kind of mentioned that in passing, and you might want to just look at, see what triggers that. Is that a mandatory thing? Is it something that GIRC does if they think it's, I don't know.
No, we're responsible for reporting whether or not there would be an impact, an economic impact, but who the economic impact is to, I'm not sure. Okay. Certainly if something like this were a recommendation of the committee, then the economic impact would look at the idea of this will help our new licensees, our new applicants who have done this, help the financial burden, help ease the financial burden, I guess is what I'm looking at. Okay. So that would be the impact study, is that it would ease the burden. The flip side of that would be that it would also impact the fund, the agency's fund overall as well. So somehow that would have to, you know, be compared.
Right, definitely. Both sides have to be looked at, yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I've got that down as something that we should look into with the committee, whichever members. Unless there's further discussion, then let's flip to Article 2. That's licensing provisions. Yeah, Linda?
Sorry. I was trying to look it up, but I wasn't that fast. So I was looking at number 13, the course evaluation tool. It's the date is 2009, and I was trying to check to see if there something newer that's been published that we should be using. It looks like there might be a 2014 publication, but I mean, I can't look at that and be here.
are you talking about the coursework evaluation tool for foreign education?
Yes. The date is 2009, and it might have been updated. I'm not sure. I was just curious because that seems like a long time ago.
Good point.
There are multiple, I'm not real sure of my parameters as to what I should be interjecting here, but just food for thought, if that's something that you discuss, there are multiple coursework evaluation tools, and they're designed in different ways to address potentially certain graduation years and beyond. Our current rules indicate coursework tool 5, which was the most current at that time. The FCCPT, the FSBPT, who developed the course evaluation tool, coursework tool, I guess, CWT. There are additional versions, and the approach has changed over many years. So
that seems like something we should address then.
Well, it's on the list. I will say this.
I think some of that understanding is to accommodate, say somebody was foreign trained a long time ago. They may not have the newer version, so it may not be fair to them to have this. Anyway, another discussion.
Well, and it's a point well made, Linda. I think it's important that we look at that. I know in other 2019 changes that are being pursued, they attempted to get away from citing a specific document in the rules rather than use language that the coursework tool currently approved by the board is posted on their website. So that may be an alternative, which would be, once again, to remove the date and go to a more generic form. But it's on the list. That's item B. Anything else from Article 1? Article 2, licensing provisions. And you can see there's a lot of strikeouts where in 2019 we tried to remove all of the nitpicky questions. And once again, updated for digital submission of things, for, you know, everything doesn't have to be in paper. reinstatement of license, application requirements, foreign educated.
So two things just to give a heads up, Peggy, that are on the AZPTA's legislative agenda, which I think got sent to the board. But one is to change the designation of PTAs from certified to licensed. And the other is about the requirements for foreign educated applicants with the TOEFL.
Would you repeat that second one?
The foreign educated applicants, the TOEFL requirements, which I think's in the statutes. Not sure if it's in the rules.
It is in the rules.
Yes, yes.
Is it specific to which versions of the TOEFL? I gotta see.
Yeah.
Okay, that's R424203.
Yeah. And the request that went from the AZPTA out is that the requirements on the TOEFL be in line with the national standards that are being used, whereas the current ones in Arizona are more stringent.
Blair, I'm going to ask you to put on your Federation hat, or Judy, who keeps up with the Federation. I mean, and I know they've just come out with a new Model Practice Act. We're talking rules, not statute, but I'm wondering what the current thinking is. I guess that's something we'll research.
On which issue?
The TOEFLs.
Yeah, and I'm not up to date on that one. I can speak to the first issue that Jim brought up about the designations, but I'm not current on the TOEFL issue.
TOEFL is in statute, not necessarily TOEFL, just an English language examination. The score levels are in rule.
Yeah. So the request is to look at the score levels from the AZPTA.
Okay. I got that as D. Blair, do you have something you were going to add as far as the designation of PTAs? Get rid of the certified and everybody gets licensed.
The designation of PTAs or PTs?
PTAs.
Well, as far as licensure, I would support the licensure. I think that we were, I think that we're probably in the smaller. I was an advocate of the certification when it first came out, but I think most practice act have moved towards licensure and not differentiating the two. So as a personal, position, I would support the chapter recommendation.
Okay.
One thing I did notice though is that it is in statute, physical therapist assistant means a person who meets the requirements of this chapter for certification. So it would definitely be something that, that we'd have to change statute for to change to licensure.
Exactly. And
that bill has just been presented.
Oh, okay.
So Tom, the Dorn group presented a couple bills, three bills on behalf of the state, association.
Awesome.
And one is to change in the statutes, the designation from certified to licensed. So yeah, it has to hit both. We can't do much on that until the stat.
Right, gotcha. Certification. So.
Now, Jim, was there also a bill regarding the designation of physical therapists, the regulatory designation, or no?
No.
Okay. All right.
No, we stayed away. I can pull up. There's three bills. SB 1266, which is imaging. Then there's another one SB1267, and that addresses student assistive personnel, students, and then supervision of physical therapist assistants, and I think certification. Yeah. And then the third one is about 1268. It's about access, modification of access.
Does that second bill cover anything regarding a position on PTAs being able to supervise technicians at all?
No, it did not go into that. It was hitting the supervision of physical therapist assistants and some of the restrictions we have in our statutes.
Okay.
So specifically supervision of PT assistants, not PT aides, techs.
No, but that bill also puts in there, defines students as being separate from assistive personnel. And I can share, I mean, though I got those that they have been submitted, so they should be, so they have been introduced. Senator Shope introduced them. So they should be public record, right? I don't know how. I'm sure other people on this call know how that works a lot better than I do.
Bills are a matter of public record, but what I need to step in and caution us is we are subject to open meeting law, and the statute changes. We should potentially discuss for a future agenda item. So we just have to tread lightly, because there might be others who want to attend the meeting for those discussions. So I'm channeling Giovanni, and Karen will understand I'm channeling Mr. Harris.
Thank you. Judy, at any time in there, if you need to tell me to stop talking, please do.
No, it's a viable topic, and it impacts what we're doing here, but we'll need to put that on the agenda for another meeting.
But for our purposes tonight, it is appropriate to see that there are some things we're talking about that would require statutory changes. The discussion of those changes will come subsequently.
Yep. Just a quick follow-up on Jim, and I don't want to get in the weeds here, but when you look at the supervision of the PTA issue, you know, right now in statute, it clearly includes the PTA under assistive personnel, and so the statute requires that supervision. And I assume that what Jim's doing is, or the chapter's doing, is something that might change that. But nope. You'd separate them from. Didn't you say you separate them from the
students, not physical therapist assistants.
Okay.
Students being separate from assistants.
That's what I'm going to. I'm going to the students as well, whether it's PT or PTA. So in the statutes, there's requirements for supervision of those, and in the substantive policy statement of the board, which, as you said earlier, Peggy, you know, was the basis of some of the ratios and those type of things. There's one thing in there that I think, and I came before the board years ago and tried to point out what I thought was an error in that statement. And that was where it talked about, and then we'll have to go back and visit this as a group here, where it talks about the fact that they're under supervision and that the physical therapist has responsibility for the evaluation of a patient, those type of things, than a PT student or a PT, let's stick with PT students, they couldn't be involved with, you know, they couldn't have the responsibility for the evaluation. And what that substantive policy statement did was ignored the statutory clause that dealt with exemptions. So exemption A is the fact that students are exempted from licensure provisions. And that was written in there. And I was involved with the drafting of the Model Practice Act and the opinion that's still in the seventh edition. that says why that's there, so that the students, so that PT under supervision can still have a physical therapist student do everything. Do the initial evaluation, come up with a treatment plan, those type of things. And that is specifically identified in the substantive policy statement as being prohibited. So there's a conflict between that statement and what the statute is intended to do. And I think this group needs to have a discussion about that, which is kind of part of the supervision issue that Jim brings up.
Okay, but that kind of relates to that SPS. Students not performing. Got it.
Yep.
Okay. Article 2 continues with renewal. And then it gets to timeframes, which we really can't mess with. Other than the editorial change that Jeannie did to take all the hyphens out of timeframes, which is fine by me. So Article 2, anything that we haven't touched upon that looks like it maybe needs to be?
Yep. One thing in the changes, you have the term clinical performance instrument. Is that a generic term or is that referring to the CPI specifically?
Definition, clinical performance instrument means a tool used to assess an individual's knowledge, skills, and attitude for readiness to work as a PT or PT assistant as applicable that is accepted by the board and listed on its website. Okay. So it is a generic term for whatever tool the board feels it needs to use. That's where I'm kind of indicating they're trying to get away from citing specific documents.
I agree. I like that.
Okay, that addresses
it. Making sure it wasn't, I missed that on definitions, making sure it wasn't indicating one specific instrument, that it was a term. Like, I like how now we then have to make sure it's on the website, correct? That's the second part.
Right, right. It's got to be posted. Renewal we talked about. I was just going to check to make sure that there was no concerns at this point from the academicians among us as it relates to the supervised clinical practice period. Everything is working? Of course, that's not specific to students. That could be foreign educated. So let me not cloud the issue by getting ahead of myself.
So we deal with a lot of foreign educated issue. And as far as I understand, but I will touch base with that group, those rules are not, have not been prohibitory.
There is something I just noticed in the actual statute document, the applicable statute document that's in your folder. That document itself is going to be updated. There is one discrepancy that repeats itself a couple of times. So it will impact the numbering slightly. Good moral character has been stricken by statute. So that document will be updated after today's meeting.
Okay, which document is this that will be updated? The statute document?
The statute. The statute.
I don't hear any assertions for anything else in Article 2, but we've got several things to look into.
I think Blair already addressed this, but yeah, I don't like nights either, but you know, and I am getting ready to not work too, but I still like working, so I'm a weirdo. The code of ethics, is that 2020 is the updated date?
That is correct.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, let's go to Article 3, practice of physical therapy. My own personal favorite. Hold on. So I'll throw it open to the group. I'll be specific in a minute. Anything from, we've got lawful practice, use of titles. And you can see they are finally formally getting rid of the periods for our titles. Patient care management in 2019, the only change that was made there, oh no, it was made under adequate patient records. Patient care management, association, universities, anybody looking at that with any concern? Patient care management, then we get to adequate patient records, and this was the one where you can see Karen Donahue's name all over this one, where she needed to insert current functional status in several of these documentation standards. Anything that should be discussed with PT Association or otherwise? I mean, I'm okay if we leave it the way it is. It's just less work for us to do.
Peg, I'm not sure if this is the place somewhere in this area or a different area to talk about it, but I know our board investigator has asked me to have us try to define if we're able to when the PT patient relationship ends. And there's been obviously some issues with that, and so I don't know if that's like under the discharge summary part of it or if there's just in a different area completely.
Well, I'm looking at discharge. I mean, it's required that you have a discharge for each patient.
I'm is trying that, to think. Sharon, is that, what's the reason for that question? Is there, can you go a little deeper?
There's been some blurring of the lines with people being brought up before the board. Doing things for their patients, like buying them clothes or going to lunch or things like that, where there really is that still that division of power. They weren't friends before they became PT patient.
And even up to romantic relationships.
Leading up to that or the potential for that.
You know, I'll just share that. You know, several years ago, we actually took out of APTA documents the term discharge because right. because of the focus on an ongoing professional right. relationship. You know, are you my physical therapist? Are you my physician? Are you my dentist? Mm-hmm. So that type of relationship that continues right. on beyond an episode of care.
Right.
And so I think that would be a good thing, Peggy, to put on your list for discussion with this group to see how we feel about that, and if you can justify that one day you have a patient relationship and just by virtue of a discharge summary that ends and you're free and clear from, you know, you have a free pass for other things that might happen after that. So it's not an easy discussion, but probably one we ought to have.
We definitely should have it.
You know, it's interesting, Karen, in the under, let me see where I'm at here. Under D, discharge summary. If care is provided in an acute care hospital, the discharge summary constitutes an inclusion of care. And then it doesn't say anything about that in the other thing. So I'm curious, kind of curious that it doesn't mention that in the other type of setting, because it seems clearer relative to the acute care setting. But it's definitely yeah. something we should have a conversation about.
Yeah. I can see it be much more definitive in an acute care setting as opposed to more of an outpatient setting, which I do believe we are looking for that, you know, continuum of care through the lifespan. And so, it could be a different.
Well, and that particular language as it relates to the acute care setting had to do entirely with the who had to do the discharge.
Right.
Because oftentimes patients are discharged after fairly short inpatient stays.
Right.
And the PT doesn't see them on the last visit. So I believe that exception was written not so much when does care end, but who is responsible for that termination of care documentation. And that's where the setting was pulled out, but that's going to be an interesting discussion as far as where that needs to go, where this whole issue of episode of care versus therapeutic relationship over the course of someone's lifetime versus, you know, what are the distinguishing characteristics. I've got that down as big number E.
Yeah.
I think that it's an important discussion to have and to perhaps include people who are from small communities, all of us from, because I think this is a very different question for someone who lives in Phoenix versus someone who's in Wilkes, Arizona. And so I think that we need to potentially include someone who's from a smaller community in that discussion and dialogue, because I think that might be very different.
And also the other thing, I mean, we are small. I mean, Karen, you were my PT probably 8 years ago. Does that mean we could never hang out in a social situation ever again?
Right. And I think that's different. I think we can be social, but, you know, do we, I mean, you know, that's, but yeah, I get it.
It's mired in all kinds of things and definitely relating it to the code of ethics. So whichever group or individuals pick up on this one, I mean, you're definitely going to need to use, what do other states do? I think that's where FSBPT will come in handy, to see how other states have addressed this issue of when does a patient-provider relationship end.
Yeah.
And what needs to be documented. So that's going to be multiple directions, but I think now is the time to look at that, because from mm-hmm. your perspective, I think they get plenty of issues that come before them that are complaints that have to do with termination of patient relationship.
Mm-hmm. I think that Lori pointed out in that paragraph, you know, two pieces of language that I think we can focus on. You know, one is discharge summary.
Mm-hmm.
And what the APTA did in their documents is focused more on conclusion of care or conclusion of episode of care. And so things were retitled in APTA documents focusing on that and getting rid of the word discharge, so that there was that ability to focus on a continuity of a relationship, of a professional relationship.
I chose to do that in my documentation where I work. We don't discharge our patients.
I do too.
You know, they mm-hmm. continue on.
Right.
I was looking at that, what you pointed out, Peggy, as far as that reporting, because we, our documentation reporting a patient's current functional status, is there somewhere where the word functional is defined? Because that seems like a very vague statement to have to add in it, compared to, you know, is it different from patient signs and symptoms? Is it different than what the patient reports?
It's all over your EHR.
Are you suggesting that maybe we need to have a definition of function?
Well, right, because...
So back to Article 1, I think, although maybe not, but definitions would belong.
Very vague statement. And it's not kind in many situations.
Okay. Functional status, got it. That's big F. I was looking to see, because the only thing in statute that refers to record keeping at all is grounds for discipline in which failing to maintain adequate patient records. Number 20, for the purpose of this paragraph, adequate patient records means legible records that comply with board rules, that's where the board rules come in, and that contain at a minimum an evaluation of objective findings, a diagnosis, the plan of care, the treatment record, a discharge summary, and sufficient information to identify the patient. So whether that would need to arc back to statute, maybe remaining it in rules is not going to be problematic. I just wanted to check and see what statute says about discharge summary.
And piggybacking on that thought, I understand what the APTA is doing in changing it to episode of care or I'm sorry, I'm not a PT, I just play one on TV. one of the things that the rules are utilized for is people call and they're looking for direction. And what does this mean? And what does that mean? The flip side of that is if a case is brought before the board, the investigators are looking to see where are their violations or are they compliant or not compliant. So there are some components that we need to make sure that are a little bit clear. I anticipate the episode of care question going, does that mean if I'm going on vacation, I'm ending my episode of care and somebody else is taking over? Those kinds of questions will come. So that's just a thought from the peanut gallery. That's
okay. Well, it's certainly on our list. And it might behoove us, something I didn't put in the shared folder, but I could, would be the newest Model Practice Act, which is version.
There's a link to it in there.
Okay. Because once again, that could be a resource for whoever is working on these issues to see, you know, what's the standard, national standard. Okay, complaints of investigation. Hearings, I don't think we're mucking around with those. Subpoenas.
Peggy, one more thing, back to the supervision or patient care management and 303, R424-303, there is a recommend, we need to talk with the physical therapist assistants, and the Arizona PT Association about B, that on the date of service, a physical therapist shall, and then determine whether it's appropriate to use assistive personnel and things like that. That, there was a request from them to change that a bit.
Really? Well, I guess they'll have to give us some language that they're thinking about on each date of service.
You read my mind on that, Jim.
Sorry, Giovanni, again, please tell me to be quiet.
No, you're good.
So let me
the other thing I want to talk at in regard to 303 is at letter C and the amount of the amount of assistive personnel that a physical therapist can potentially have under them.
Mm-hmm.
Noticing that there are a lot of other states that allow, you know, the PT to make the decision on how many people they feel comfortable supervising. I think it could open up a lot better access to care for patients if we open up that supervision.
Okay, so you're talking about the ratios under C.
The ratios, yeah. And I don't see the ratios being specific to statute, so it looks like they're more in the rules, so there could be some potential to change that.
Well, it would be great to make sure that it's the PT and not who they work for, telling them how many people they have to supervise.
Definitely, and I think that's
I mean, like, that's a really, because I do know people in other states. I've mentored different people throughout the United States through the APTA, and yes, we do micromanage a little bit here, but I'd rather have that than what other people have had to deal with.
Yeah, and I'm open to there being a number. I'm just wondering if maybe we need to increase that number, you know, to a specific number of PTAs as well as a specific number of techs, rather than lumping them all together under just assistive personnel, and you can only supervise up to three.
Well, I'm going to throw into the mix how absolutely arbitrary that number is and was developed. There is, somebody pulled it out of the ether, okay? At the time, the discussion was, okay, well, a physical therapist could potentially see up to 20 patients a day, right? And if other personnel could see up to 20, is there a maximum number of individuals that a physical therapist could humanly be responsible for in any given day? And then somebody said, how about 3? And so there is nothing sacred about that number. Certainly, Giovanni, maybe that's one you want to jump on. I don't know who's going to take which of these issues, but from the get-go, the ratio has been totally arbitrary.
Yeah.
Well, and it that intimately connected with students being identified as assistive personnel.
Mm-hmm. Which certainly was never intended in the Malpractice Act.
And
I mean, aren't extenders, students are there for other purposes. So that was, remember, a board interpretation who felt that students fell within that definition of assistive personnel, but
also along those lines that there's an interpretation in the line education that I forget where that line is, whether it's in the statute or the rules, that the board oversees education, which then limits student participation, or education and research, which then limits student participation in research activities with faculty, within service activities as a student. It's actually really crazy. Like, you go out to do physicals for Special Olympics and you have to have one PT for every 2 students that are there in order to do that. Or if someone makes a complaint, we're out of compliance. Same thing with research. I can go to ASU and have 10 research undergrad and or graduate students under my supervision doing research as long as it's IRB approved. But if I'm at Creighton or NAU or AT Still, I'm limited to 2 under my supervision for research.
Interesting.
I guess I'm a little confused because, you know, supervision relates to patient care management, and I'm not sure how that would affect any research activities by students. I don't mean to argue with you, Jim. I'm just trying to understand what the connection is between supervision of research activities. I mean, this doesn't even address supervision within the context of research.
There's a couple words, and it's been interpreted by the board to include all education practices and research.
Karen or Giovanni, can either of you address where the board has interpreted it?
That didn't happen during my time, so no. I am not aware.
I've not seen that either.
Okay, well, Jim, I'll just ask you to kind of get a little more definitive in where any kind of supervision would relate to research or...
I think it's under the definition of practice. I could be wrong. I'll look it up. We don't need to...
Okay.
Yeah, I do remember it under the definition of practice for sure. But not under patient care management. So
that's where
the practice definition is 32.2001, and you're talking about number 13. It includes in the practice of physical therapy that it includes administration, research, teaching, et cetera, et cetera. So
education and research. That's it. That's the clause.
And those individuals need to be licensed. So in this state, if you're a teacher, if you're an administrator, if you're a researcher, you need a license to do it.
Right. But it's been extended to that the supervision ratios under patient care management have extended to research and education. And that's been a long-standing position of the board.
Okay. That's because it's part of practice, defined as part of practice.
Well, I used to have this discussion with Lori, your former boss, James. You know, he took the argument that his faculty did not have to be licensed under the state of Arizona. And, you know, that they shouldn't have to be licensed. That was his argument, and we went around on this a number of different times, and I said, well, that's not how the statute reads. And you know, this argument that Jim Linsky's bringing up is a little more nuanced about supervision, but James, just clear out, we shouldn't have to be licensed. We're regulated by CAPTI and by higher education and those type of things. And so I've been involved with some of those discussions. Well,
I know Jim's passion for it. And I'll tell you that right now I have a team member who's a licensed practitioner, a licensed physical therapist in Canada, and in the state of New York, but he cannot teach clinical courses based on our understanding of the law, and he was licensed until Arizona.
Right. And I'll just tell you, with the draft of the Model Practice Act, our intent was to include educators that they should be licensed in their state. So again, yeah, that's something you need to go away from. I'm fine to have this discussion, but that was the original intent.
Yeah. But I think it is nuanced as it relates to the supervisory piece and limitations and that puts on us for doing any kind of community service activity in collaboration with students.
And also with the compact, can someone teach in the state of Arizona if they're compact approved? But once they actually get a residence and a license in the state of Arizona, their compact is null and void. But,
good question.
Right. Is compact privilege equivalent to licensure in the state? That's what I hear you asking.
That's something we need to address.
Deep subject there.
The compact has a complete statute unto itself. That is a core requirement of the compact, is that an individual who establishes residency in the state cannot practice under a compact privilege. And that's across all compact states. That's part of the compact statute.
So we have people who live here part-time,
mm-hmm,
who maintain their residency elsewhere,
mm-hmm,
who could be licensed under compact and not break that law,
mm-hmm,
not break that statute.
Mm-hmm.
Are they allowed to teach?
Mm-hmm.
But our stuff says license, not compact.
Your stuff says
So that faculty must be licensed. Is compact equal to license? That's what.
No. That's interesting. That's an interesting interpretation, because there is a statute for compact. Yes, the practice of physical therapy in Arizona includes education, administration, but that is not necessarily that they have to be licensed per se for that. It can be a compact privilege as long as it's relative to all the compact privilege requirements as well. They are practicing physical therapy. They're doing so under the compact privilege, which is not a license. They have the same capabilities of practice. The privilege is not a compact license. It is a compact privilege to practice in a remote state based on your home state license. So there's been a lot of discussion about that, and we're probably steering off of the beaten path again here a little bit. But no, this is a valid point that we should discuss further. But there is a lot of misunderstanding of the compact and the privileges and how that all works. I'm happy to go into great detail about how those things can work and the various discussion that has been brought about, especially with respect to education. But that 32.2001, anybody practicing is required to abide by the statutes and the rules of the state, but that doesn't mean that they can only be a teacher if they are licensed by the state of Arizona. If they are a resident of the state of Arizona by virtue of driver's license, all of that other stuff, permanent residence, then they must be licensed in this state. If it's somebody that's a snowbird per se or something along those lines, but they maintain a permanent residence elsewhere, then the compact privilege can be a discussion as long as they meet all of the requirements of either one. So, I'm happy to discuss that in this meeting. Jim, I'm happy to talk to you about it offline.
And I think if that's going to be one of the areas we're going to look into, then I certainly think, Jim, you need to read the sections of our statute that are specific to the compact privilege. Yes. Because it's not a license, but it is a privilege to act like a physical therapist or PT assistant in the state of Arizona, as long as you are licensed someplace else and you have identified yourself when you're in residency. So that's another whole statute, and it'll be under discussion, but I'd like to move on. I really would like to stick to our timetable so I'm not asleep before the end of the meeting. Anything else from Article 3?
Yes, sorry. D, 303D, the 2,000 hours is, again, something that the PTAs and the AZPTA is looking to change as well.
Read my mind again.
Are you proposing that that's something that the Rules Committee should consider as they're going through these?
Yes.
A 2,000-hour requirement?
Yes, and there's language that the AZPTA has put forth.
Okay, I'm going to call that J. Okie doke. Okay, we're going to move on to Article 4. We're not going to get into a detailed discussion tonight about continuing competence. I'm kind of skipping over the parts about, maybe I shouldn't, under Article 3, disciplinary action, substance abuse recovery program, display of license, mandatory reporting, anything in the rank and file. Dry needling standards, that's R424313. Okay, then for tonight, it's a moot point. Anybody can, go ahead, Blair. Nope, you're on mute. Blair.
Okay, I got it. So one question about mandatory reporting. This is a curiosity. That's been in there since the first, draft, the Model Practice Act was adopted into our statute. You recall, offhand, if we had anybody who's reported because they felt they had to, partly because of that statute?
You mean the self-reporting?
Yeah, the self-reporting, mandatory reporting requirements. Have we had people who reported based on that? Have you?
Yeah. Yeah, regularly, unfortunately.
Oh, good. Okay. I just, we were criticized as a federation soundly because of putting that in there by the APTA. And I always wondered, how useful that clause is going to be. And I, not being involved with the board, I was just curious if it's been effective. But that's, I mean, it's part of our code of ethics too, but yeah. Yet the APTA criticized us for, you know, requiring that. And that was APTA legal counsel who felt that was over.
Interesting. I mean, the most common occurrence is DUI. And that happens, I mean, you know, again, unfortunately, frequently. And so, but many, many people do report that. And then if when they don't report it, but have to put it on their license renewal form, then it comes back to us at that point.
Okay. All right. Well, good. I'm glad it's useful. So it was intended to be useful.
I do have a question about that. So they have to self-report when they've been charged.
Correct.
Not found guilty.
Correct.
Okay. That does seem like a bit of an overstep, but because now in day and age, you can get charged with anything for anything.
Well, then you should let your board know that you've, well, only certain things, felonies or misdemeanors involving, I have to remember what it is, mandatory reporting, I just went by it.
Patient safety or a felony shall provide written notice.
Right, so feeding sickness is not reportable, unless you're drunk and are cited for DUI, and then that's a different story.
But you're not convicted yet, and you could not be convicted.
Right. So a lot of times someone will report, and if there continues to be like a court case or further things that are going to be happen from a legal standpoint, we'll just continue until we know more, unless the person is a danger. You know, if you have somebody that's an extreme DUI or severe domestic violence or, I mean, there are some, imminent harm to the public, perhaps, that we would want to do something about right now. But a lot of times we let these things play out and then deal with it at the very end.
So what would happen if the board acts on the charge, suspends the license, suspends their livelihood, and then down the road, the person's found not guilty?
You know what, Jim? I'm just going to kind of call time out on this. This is hypothetical stuff. It's very interesting, and I appreciate you want the information, but we're now almost at 8:30. So another time, okay? That's a good question, but unless you think that's something that this group needs to look at as far as the mandatory reporting requirement.
I would like it to be a discussion.
Okay.
That's a statute. 32-3208, an applicant, licensee, or certificate holder who is charged with a misdemeanor involving conduct that may affect patient safety shall notify the board within 10 working days of the charges filed. That is the statute.
Okay. That's not what we're discussing. Okay.
Okay, so that comes off the list. Let's go to continuing competence.
I have a question. I'm sorry, Vicki. I have a question about that. So that is in the statute, but in the rules, fine. Board responded to that. Could we define?
Are you looked up?
How the board responds? I'm sorry, I didn't get. I don't. I, for note taking, I didn't get that. You broke up.
Oh, I'm sorry. So could the rules define how the board responded to a charge of something versus how the board responded to a conviction? Could the rules define that?
I don't think so. I don't think the rules define how the board responds to things. They kind of find what licensees and certificate holders have to do and what their due process is. But I don't think that's under the purview of rules.
Okay.
But we'll discuss it again when we have more time.
One of the things that we need to kind of keep involved in this, because all of these, any of these rule suggestions that are brought forward to the board, any of the desired rule changes that are brought before GIRC, the board's mission is public protection. All of this has to involve the way that the board is protecting the public and how these changes may or may not affect the protection of the public that the board is charged with doing. That is the purpose of the board.
Okay, let's go to continuing confidence. So the question is, do we need to look into the rules that are used for continuing confidence and make any changes? And we won't have a lot of time tonight, I'm afraid. Everything always takes longer than I think, but I would like to know whether there is interest and need to revise the continuing confidence rules.
Peggy, I agree with you. They are overly complex.
Mm-hmm.
They should be reviewed.
I would also say that I'm grateful that we implemented the hours for PTAs, but I still think that it's not really enough. I would like to see those go up.
Jim, does the Arizona PT Association have any goals as far as continuing competence?
The issue that was brought up was about new graduates and the requirement for the continuing competence, even of those who graduated from an accredited program in the year of license renewal. That was the issue brought up. I was trying to be quiet, Peggy.
No, that's okay. I like the conversation. I'm sorry whenever I have to kind of put a lid on something, because it's me watching the clock saying, okay, this is 2 hours. How much longer can we go on? But I like the opinions. And, I mean, they did make a compromise in the rules that if your license is for 12 months or less, you get a buy, if you will, from continuing competence. But that's as far as I think it's gone.
No. No, that's not there.
Yes,
yeah, it's 10 contact hours if you're 12 months or less.
It's prorated. 12 months or less is prorated. And for a PT,
but what it again happens is you have May graduates from a lot of our programs who get licensed in July and then are technically responsible for 10 CEUs between July 15th or whenever their license comes through and August 31st. Or for PTA, it's 6, right?
I believe so.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And they just graduated from a program.
So you're thinking maybe if you're a new graduate who gets licensed or certified, maybe it's waived for the first period of licensure? Well, that's something to explore.
Mm-hmm. It used to be. When I got licensed in 95, that's how we ran.
Yeah, well, the requirements didn't exist here in Arizona until 98.
And for purposes of discussion, complexity is one thing. There is, I understand again that there are students, but there are also other new applicants, new licensees. And if we're saying it works for this group, but not this group, there will be issues. So, issues from the individuals, as well as it adds another layer of administrative oversight to figure out who's who at the time of a 2-month renewal period. So.
Well, this is early stages. We're going to see if there are some people who would like to look into this continuing competence program we've got in Arizona, explore what's done in other states. They bring it back to this group. We start talking about it. We do further research. I mean, we're a long way from conclusions. We just want to identify which things we want to be looking at. Yeah. So I've got a big letter K. That means we're up to 11 items that we're thinking about looking at, which is fine. That's the purpose. But I'm just lumping all of continuing competence into one category, which is let's look at this mess and see if it can be improved. Article 5, public participation procedures. I wasn't even going to talk about it because, Judy, is that something pertinent?
Not that I'm aware of.
Ballywick.
I've not heard any questions or concerns about that, but I could be wrong.
Okay. Well, we'll have another meeting to discuss that. All right. It's 8:30, so we're going to, as quickly as we can, wrap it up. We have two things to do. Number one, to go, and maybe you don't want to jump into assignments yet. Maybe you'd rather see the minutes where we've identified the topics we want to look at and then communicate which ones you're interested in. Now, remember, we are a little bit constrained in our email communications because we can't cross over quorum. Quorum means if there's going to be, there are now 8 of us on the committee. Judy doesn't count on the committee. You count for everything, Judy, but not on the committee, which means quorum for our committee is 5. Okay, that's why we can't do a reply all. That's why things will have to be sent to a central clearinghouse, and then we'll see. And I can certainly understand because we're kind of on overload. If you want to see these 11 items laid out, and then you can jump in and say, yeah, I'd kind of like to keep working on this or, you know, not. Is the group kind of in agreement that we're going to not make assignments until you can look at what we've got?
I think so.
Okay. I'm seeing mostly head nodding except for those who have nodded off.
I think that would require a vote, a motion and a vote that we table the matter until the next meeting.
Okay. So this is agenda. I'm getting stuck again. I don't know.
Yeah.
Aaron.
Through
Karen.
There you go, Peg.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay, so this was possibly, we've done agenda item 5. That's what we've been talking about. Agenda item 6, rules committee member research tasks. And so can the chair make a motion?
Sure. Judy?
Then I'm going to move that we communicate through minutes and defer assignments from this, that we take no action on these assignments at this meeting.
How about we table this until we continue this until the next meeting?
And at the next meeting, we will certainly have already shared the minutes and people can communicate back to Judy. We'll communicate it to me because we're going to have a number listing and you can respond back and say, I'm really very interested in items 6 and 9. So we'll have some idea going into the next meeting. All right. So we're going to table this. It's been moved. Do I have a second?
A second.
Peg and Blair to table agenda item 6. For a future meeting.
Peg, let's give the second to Dr. Bordenave, as this is an audibly recorded meeting, please.
Okay, we good? Moved by Peg, seconded by Lori to table this assignment until the subsequent meeting.
Right. I'll read that back to you in just a second. After review and discuss, we're going to do a roll call vote. So when your name is called, after review and discussion, it was moved by Ms. Hiller and seconded by Dr. Bordenave to table this table the discussion of a breakdown of research tasks to the next meeting. Ms. Hiller.
Yes.
Dr. Bustillo.
Yes.
Mr. Leone.
Yes.
Dr. Bursell.
Yes.
Dr. Bordenave.
Yes.
Dr. Linsky.
Yes.
Mr. Packard.
Yes.
Dr. Thune.
Yes.
That motion passes.
Okay, so that gives us to the final agenda item, which is future meetings and timelines. Because we are deferring that assignment, so we can't really begin to work on things until we've made those assignments, I am going to suggest that we schedule our next meeting for an abbreviated time frame, but meet to make those assignments, at which point I think we can give ourselves 2 months or 6 weeks or whatever to do what we need to do to start gathering information. So with your blessing and understanding that it will be abbreviated meeting to make assignments and add anything we neglected, maybe you've had food for thought, you read the minutes, you say, boy, I meant to put on the table a review of something else, but I'm looking at a 1 hour meeting maximum to gather, make assignments, and then figure out what our subsequent meeting schedule would be. Does this meet the approval of the committee? Is this something we need to have a motion for to schedule our next meeting? All right, my first question before I make the motion, Linda Tooney-Toon, Dr. Toon, are there any days of the week that you can meet during daylight hours, not evening hours?
Mondays and Fridays sometimes.
Okay.
Frequently, it depends. But like I was just looking at my calendar because yeah, I don't like nights either. Just that was one of the only options that came up.
Okay.
Like, I mean, if you want to meet in a couple of weeks on the 12th in the morning, I'm available.
Okay, but the 12th is a Monday or Friday?
It's a Monday.
Yeah, I like Mondays better than Fridays. Who wants to wrap up a week with a committee meeting? Monday the 12th and the following Monday?
The 19th?
I'm just going to check my calendar to make sure the 12th is free of February.
If we could do a noon hour, a noon hour would work great for me on a Monday.
What hours did you say?
Midday.
Middle of the day? I see heads nodding. Giovanni, can you do a middle of the day meeting?
If I have enough notice and I can, I typically train on Mondays, but I don't have anything scheduled for the 12th, so I'd be good for that one.
JJ?
Yeah, I can make 12 o'clock work on both the 12th and 19th.
Okay. Then let's go for it. So I guess I move that our next – is it okay if I make both motions? I don't want to be a hog here. But I would move that our next meeting of the committee would be – at noon on February 12th, and the agenda would be to discuss and divide research tasks for committee work.
Peggy, the 19th works better for me than the 12th. I can make the 12th work, but I'd have to rearrange some stuff. If that's what everyone wants is the 12th, I'll make it work.
I was going to say, as long as we're restricted to the hour, I can do either of those.
Okay. I'm good either the 12th or the 19th. Now, the 19th is President's Day. I don't know if that's a state holiday.
I'm going to be on a beach. I'm not available.
On the 19th. Let's hope we can make it.
You.
Pardon?
I said I want to be you.
It's my first vacation in a year and a half.
Well deserved.
So was the 12th going to work for everybody?
I'll make it work.
Thank you very much, Giovanni. All right, I'm going to move that our subsequent committee meeting will be at noon on February 12th. Do I have a second?
That was Giovanni that seconded?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Judy will read us back the motion so we can vote.
It's been moved by Ms. Hiller and seconded by Mr. Leone to meet on February 12th at 12 p.m. to discuss tabled matters as well as revisit any outstanding old business. Ms. Hiller. I'm sorry, that didn't come through.
Yes.
Thank you. Dr. Bastillo? Dr. Bastillo exited. She'll be right back. Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Dr. Purcell?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you. Dr. Bastillo?
Yes.
Thank you. Dr. Bordenave?
Yes.
Dr. Linsky?
Yes.
Mr. Packard?
Yes.
Dr. Thune?
Yes.
That motion passes.
Okay, so you will, within a week, I may give myself 10 days, you will get minutes distributed through Judy. Everything comes through the board office. They will identify these lists of tasks. I've got 11 right now, at which point you'll be able to take a look at them, see which ones most intrigue you. Clearly, there's going to be some overlap. We only have 8 of us and 11 items, but some of them might be easy. And then we'll go from there. I really appreciate this. You're digging deep, you guys. Well, cut that from the minutes, but praise be to all of you. Thank you for the evening time, for your willingness to serve. It's going to be a hell of a ride.
We're going to need a motion to adjourn in a minute, but first, prior to that, does everybody have access to that shared drive without issue? Okay, because that's how documentation will be distributed. So please keep.
Can I make a request that we make sure that we can download things? I couldn't download the files from.
You can't download the files.
Everybody else.
I was able.
Could everybody else download them?
If you open the file, you can download it to any file on your computer once it's open.
It wouldn't let me do that. I'll try it again. I'll try it on a different lap. I'll try it on a different computer.
See if it works.
If not, I'll let you know.
You might be able to open it and print it to PDF as well.
No. Couldn't do it.
No? All right. Well, let me know if you have any trouble. We can troubleshoot that.
I will.
Okay, so then you need a motion to adjourn, please.
I move that we adjourn.
That was Dr. Bornave.
I said Dr. Linsky first, so.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded to adjourn at 8:43 p.m. Ms. Hiller?
Yes.
Dr. Bastillo?
Yes.
Mr. Leone?
Yes.
Dr. Bissell?
Yes.
Dr. Bordenave?
Yes.
Dr. Lindsay?
Yes.
Mr. Packard?
Yes.
Dr. Thune?
Yes.
That motion passes and the meeting is adjourned at 8:44 p.m. Thank you all. The recording will stop in a moment at 8:44.